Let me give you a good reason not to be a Christian. The Christian dies just as the atheist dies. Let me give you a better reason to be a Christian. The atheist dies just as the Christian dies. Now think about that for a minute. If what the atheists say is true, that there is no God, or that if there was at once upon a time a God, he no longer exists, and the Christian lives a Christian life, all we have done is forfeited a few short years on this earth that, according to the atheist anyway, ends in nothingness to a moral code and a way of living that ultimately makes the world a better place anyway. Christians are more caring toward others, better toward their neighbors, have better families, more stable marriages, and do much more benevolent work and relief work and caring work among humans on this earth. But if the Christian is right and the atheist is wrong, the atheist has enjoyed a few short years of partying on this earth for an eternity in hell. Now, an atheist would not get those first opening lines of this lesson. 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 4 even says it this way: they will think it strange that you do not run after the same dissipation. It's an interesting word, when it used a whole lot. It means drunken stupors that they do. They will think it odd. Why don't you party like we do? Why don't you have a good time like we do? I mean, you're forfeiting this life to a moral code that says you've got to be with one woman if you marry for your whole life. You've forfeited the fun of having money to ethics. You've forfeited the fun of using any kind of language you want to controlling your tongue. You've forfeited being sober to our drunkenness. Well, again, if the atheist is right, all he's got is a few years of partying, and then it's all over, period, end of game, and he's not done any good in this world anyway, in all likelihood. But if the Christian is right, sadly, with no joy, the atheist will spend his eternity in a devil's hell, while the Christian enjoys eternity with a Father who loves them. There are two primary passages we're going to look at this morning. The first one we're not going to spend long with. You don't have to turn there, but if you'd like to, it's 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 19. Regardless of if you turn there or not, I do want you to hear it clearly. If in this life only we have hope in Christ, we are of all men most miserable. Now, can I ask your permission for a few minutes to toy with that verse just a little bit? I don't do that often, but I want to play with that verse just a minute and to talk about what it doesn't say and what it could say. I want us to consider, if we just took a couple of words out of this verse, if in this life only we have hope, we are miserable. Can you postulate that? Can you concrete that in your mind for a few minutes? That's not what the verse says, but some people read it that way. If in this life only we have hope, we are of all men, we are miserable. There are a lot of people who put their hope in this life. There are a lot of people who have hope only in this life. Their hope is in the here and now. Their hope is in what they can touch, what they can feel, what is right in front of their nose. And it's not shocking. Over in 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 3, it says that, and we talked about this on Wednesday nights a while back if you were in our class, scoffers will come scoffing. And they will say, where's the promise of his return? You say, Christian, that Jesus said he was coming back, but he hasn't come back. In fact, they will say, everything has continued as it was since the very beginning of time. Can you hear that? Can you hear that in the non-believers? I mean, it's been 2,000 years since this Christ left and what you say was angels going into heaven and said, I'll come back. He hadn't come back. He's not coming back. That's what they would say. And those people have determined, since he hasn't come back, he won't come back, which is the dumbest argument that's ever been made. Since it hadn't happened, it won't happen. I'll go back to Scott's analogy earlier. Since the Titans haven't won, they won't win, right? I noticed this morning that somebody, I don't remember who it was, came in. They had a Tennessee umbrella. It's sitting outside. I started to bring it up here, but I was afraid I might fumble it. You're welcome. A lot of people put their hope in the here and now. Peter is saying these people have tied their hope to here, to this world. They are anchored in this world. They've got an anchor and it's sitting firmly in this world and everything about. The problem is, and you know this, we see it all around us. There is nothing sure in this world. Again, read the perverted verse I've played with here. If in this life only we have hope, we are miserable. Steve Jobs, with all the money in the world, could not do anything to affect his health ultimately. And if I understand his mentality right, he had hope only in this world. With all the money in the world, he left it. Steve Hawking, some would argue, was the most intelligent man in the world. But with all his intelligence, he could not solve the problem of death. Everything that he was here in this life, only he had hope. In 2009, Forbes magazine did an interview with Henry Kissinger and asked Kissinger, who are the smartest men in the history of the world? His impressive list included Julius Caesar, Peter the Great, Mahatma Gandhi, Napoleon, and Teddy Roosevelt. And I read the list and I thought one thing, how did Teddy Roosevelt get on that list? But that's another story. The list also included men of all sorts of tremendous power. And every man on his list had tremendous power. But with all their power, they could not extend their life one day. So it is definable. If in this life only we have hope, we are miserable. Ultimately, when you pillow your head at night and you only have hope in this life, you pillow your head knowing, I may not wake up tomorrow, and if I don't wake up tomorrow, there's nothing. How miserable is that? That has led many of those of Generation X and many millennials to the conclusion that why should I get a job? Why should I get an education? Why should I care where I live? Why should I care how I look? Why should I care who I date? Why should I care who I go to bed with? Why should it matter? It doesn't matter at all because this life is all there is. And it's led to a generation that has the highest suicide rate in any history of our country. And frankly, if in this life we only have hope, I don't blame them. Because life is painful. It hurts. But over here is John Christian. And he may have no real, definable, in this world power. He may have all kinds of power, but in my illustration, he has no in-this-world power. He cannot do anything that will affect his health, his future. He can't buy it. He can't insure it. But when he dies, that is not all that he has. Now, I hope you'll remember that I twisted that verse a little bit, and I did it for a reason. How I twisted it is still true. We're going to come back to it later in the lesson. But let me plant this seed in your mind. Without a life after this life, the life of Christianity makes no sense at all. But without Christ, this life makes no sense at all. I shared that statement in another one with one of our shepherds. I won't tell you his initials, but his name is Stephen Heffington. And he said, well, did you come up with that by yourself? Yeah. We have many differences. We don't dress alike. We don't like the same foods. We read different types of books. We enjoy different kinds of movies, different types of music. But there's one thing we all have in common. We all know what it means to hurt. Suffering is a universal language. When life hurts, dreams fade, questions come, or despair sets in, each one of us knows the sting of pain, heartache, disease, trial, or suffering. Joseph Parker once said to a group of aspiring young ministers, "Preach to the suffering and you will never lack a congregation. There is a broken heart in every pew." He didn't know we didn't have pews here. But it shouldn't surprise us that there's a book in the New Testament that addresses this whole thing. I ask you two passages. I'd invite you to turn to the book of 1 Peter. I don't know how much you know about the book of 1 Peter. It is an absolutely awesome book. Without it and its neighbor, 2 Peter, we would not have any words written by Peter himself. Peter, who played such an important role in the life of Christ. Peter, who was there at the feeding of the 5,000. Peter, who walked on water. You know how hard it is to walk on water? I think I've shared this with you before, but if I haven't, it's worth sharing. Back in 1993 at Maywood Christian Camp, we decided to spend the week of camp studying as a theme the parables of Jesus, the stories of Jesus' life, and the miracles of Jesus. So our morning devotions every morning were on the parables of Christ. The Bible classes were on the miracles of Christ, and the nighttime lesson was on the teachings of Jesus. In the morning, we decided we're going to do some big stuff. And so we tried to recreate each of the miracles. I know we couldn't, but we tried to put people in the scene. The grand finale was Friday night. Friday night at camp. You know what Friday night at camp's like, isn't it? I mean, it is awesome, isn't it? If you've ever been to camp, you know how marvelous Friday night. You try to do something memorable and great. And so we spent the whole week. Drew, Aaron, and David. I commissioned them. Friday night, we're going to make Jesus walk on the water. So every night when the kids would all go to bed, they would go out to the Sea of Galilee, our little man-made dug lake we had out there, and they built a platform about an inch below the water line. Jesus was going to walk on the water. Every night, every morning, I'd ask them, "How's it going?" They'd wearily say, "It's going well, but it's not easy. It's going well, it's not easy." The last night, Friday night, came up, and Jesus walked on the water. What we didn't know, Drew, who was playing the role of Jesus that night, was walking out on this 1 inch under the water plank, looking like he was walking on the water, this little bridge they built out there. But Brad, out near the end, you know how that lake is out near the end? They hadn't quite finished it. And so David and Aaron were standing on either side of that little bridge they built and holding it up with snorkels on with their head under the water. And I remember thinking, if Jesus crashes, we're in trouble. Peter, who walked on the water. Peter, who said he would not, even if he had to die, deny Jesus, but then did and cussed while he did it. But Peter heard Jesus say, "Feed my sheep," and received his forgiveness after he sinned. Peter, who preached the first gospel sermon. 1 Peter, many people believe, and I've told you this, I know, before, many people believe the book of 1 Peter are sermon notes from a sermon that Peter preached at a baptism. I love that thought. The story is that when Alexander Campbell, and some of you know that name, one of our great preachers in our past, when Alexander Campbell was baptized, that he preached a seven-hour sermon. I tell you that only to say you're getting off easy today. It's a 6.5. 1 Peter is written to a group of people who are being singed by the flames of persecution that in just a few years will take Peter's life itself. They're in the midst of severe persecution, yet Peter did not try, you know, to pump them up with positivity, positive thinking. Instead, he gently reached his hand to their chins and lifted their faces toward the sky, and he pointed to the one who was above their circumstances. And anytime I think about that word we've focused on already today, that word hope, I think about looking at something that is above our circumstances. In fact, that word hope is used three times in 1 Peter chapter 1. So we've got 3 points today. Point number one. Look at verse 3. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. According to His great mercy, He has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance that is imperishable. Number one, you were born to a living hope. If we were born to a living hope, then why does life often feel hopeless? If we're born to living hope, Christian, why does life sometimes, oftentimes for some of you, feel hopeless? Because we have an enemy, remember? And he will use whatever he can to create doubt in your heart. He will reframe stuff, death and loss, and he will make it look like that is the end of something, that God has taken something from us instead of preparing something for us. He will try to trick us into believing that here should be perfect. Whether the here is the world or the church, that it should be perfect. And since it is not, there must not be a God, instead of the fact that here was never designed to be perfect. But here is corrupted by sin, and we are attempting to escape here to go to there. He will trick us into believing that we've been abandoned instead of a promise from Him who cannot lie, that He is with us and dwells in us. He'll try to convince us that life is long and painful instead of short and a time to not hurt, but to point others to Jesus and to share with them our hope. We are born to a living hope from a God who cannot die. Isn't it amazing? We believe the weatherman, but we don't believe God. Number two, the second use of the word hope is in verse 13. Therefore, he says, preparing your minds for action, and being sober-minded, set your hope fully on the grace that will be brought to you at the resurrection of Jesus Christ. As obedient children, do not be conformed to the passions of your former ignorance, but as He who has called you is holy, so you also be holy in all your conduct. Since it is written, you shall be holy, for I am holy. Number two, you have been given the tools to live with hope. You've been the tools in a dark world to live with hope. It is so easy to miss this. Look at the text. He says, prepare your mind. The biggest battle you have in your life is the battle with your mind. I want to tell you how to win that battle. It's very simple. Put the right things in it. David had it figured out. Listen to his words. Your word have I put in my heart, hidden in my heart, that I might not sin against you. You want to know why so many of us lose the living hope that we are called to? Because we don't put the word in our heart. We remember the wrong things. I mean, if I started asking the stuff you remembered, you got all sorts of things stored up here. And if I started asking to quote verses, you know what you'd say? I can't remember much. But you remember your PIN code, your address. You remember several of the players that start for your favorite football team. You remember how to get to your neighbor's, to your best friend's house. You remember what year you got out of high school. You may remember your phone number. You probably remembered your social security number. You've got all sorts of things. If I play the first two or three notes from your favorite television show, you could tell me how the rest of it goes. We remember a lot of stuff. Sometimes we just remember the wrong things. So first he says, prepare your minds. If you want to learn to live with this living hope, prepare your mind. Second, he says, look at it, be sober-minded. Are you with me? I looked at that verse, that word this morning, or excuse me, yesterday closely. I had not had this in my notes. I looked at it, sober-minded. And what does that mean? Does that mean he's saying don't get drunk? Well, kind of, but not like you think it means. He's not saying don't get drunk with whiskey or wine or alcohol. The problem with alcohol is not the problem with alcohol. The problem with alcohol is what alcohol does to your mind. That's the problem with alcohol, what it does to your mind. And what he's saying here is not about alcohol. He's saying don't put anything, don't put stuff in your mind that clouds it and makes you make your decisions that keep your mind off the hope of grace that we have in Jesus. And anytime our minds get fogged by anything, our vision gets clouded by anything, we forget the hope we have in us. And so whether it's possessions or prestige, power or promotions, whatever it is that gets in your mind and takes your vision off the grace of Christ, you will lose your sober-mindedness and your hope. In third, he says, be holy. What's your conduct? Number three, third time this word's used. It's in verse 21. Very neat. Who through him are believers in God, who raised him, Christ, from the dead and gave him, Christ, glory, so that you, your faith and hope are in God. Number three. We have access to the most important, are you listening? The most important fact in all the universe. We claim to base our lives on faith. But do we even understand what that means? Listen, it means we believe in God, but not just some esoterical, oh, I believe in a higher power sort of God. But we believe that God did something that changed everything. That God raised Jesus from the dead, and in that moment, everything changed. So, back to our text we started with. 1 Corinthians 15. And let me put the two words I left out back in. If in this life only we have hope in Christ, we're of all men most miserable. Oh, wait a minute. What does that mean? Well, first of all, remember, if we only have hope in this life, we're miserable. But you add Christ in there, and it's like, does that mess the verse up more if we have life? Don't I live a better life as a Christian? Paul's actually kind of contending with that. Here's misery. Believing, but not really believing. Believing, but not really being sold out. Believing to the point that it's convenient for you to believe because it fits well within our culture. Believing to the point that you like to believe simply because if you believe, it feels good to believe. Believing the point, as long as it's easy, everything's fine. And listen, it can happen to any one of us. You see, the last thing Satan wants any of us, remember I said earlier he doesn't play fair? We talked about some of his tricks. Here's another one. The last thing Satan wants any of us to do is to take this thing called Christianity really serious. Paul says, I've taken this serious to the point that if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, I'm not just miserable, I'm more miserable than anybody else. I've so staked my life in him. I'm not a halfway believer. I'm not a convenient Sunday morning believer. I'm not a I skip Bible class believer. I'm not a I don't give believer. I'm not a believer until my friend mistreats me believer. I'm not a believer until I have pain in my life believer. I'm sold out believer to the point that you can take me and put me in prison and beat me and threaten to kill me, and I'm still going to be a believer because I believe that God raised Jesus from the dead. The last thing that Satan wants us to do is take this thing called Christianity seriously. He even plays with us in worship. He wants us to evaluate a speaker based on whether he's funny or not. And he wants us to think about where we're going to have lunch later, or your text messages, or spring break, or that boy, or that girl, or that car, or that job. Anything but about for 30 minutes of who you're giving your life to. Do you think he's a fool? He's not. He's wise and crafty and subtle. He doesn't play by the rules. And he knows if he got you. He knows if he's got you. And you do too. But God, God is a God of incredible hope that gives us the tools to have hope in him. God gives hope, and we have hope in God, and we've anchored our hope in God. Nothing that Satan does will mean anything to us.